This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
Hello there, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics Wrap of the Week from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Jennifer Bray and Jack Horgan-Jones are here to round up the political themes and stories of the week. Hi to you both.
Hello.
Hi, Hugh.
Jen, Simon Harris, he's new boy in school, new head boy. What's his report card say after the first 2 weeks?
Oh, are you asking me to give him like a grade?
Yes, could do better.
I'm going to give him a C+. I think, you know, his promise was to bring a new energy. I think he's brought a frantic kind of energy. Like, he just seems to be just completely on it everywhere, every time, everything you can think of, which kind of always was his style. But I was very struck with, in his first leaders' questions outing, what I expected was not what happened. I thought that he would be, you know, I thought he would go for Sinn Féin. I thought he would go for the opposition. I thought that he would be in there to make his mark, like, I'm in the bear pit as well and I'm ready to fight. And instead it was, I mean, I kind of started snoozing halfway through. I was like, God, it's so civilised. And even, you know, Mary Lou, God love her, was trying her best to get under his skin, and he just wasn't having it. Everything was respectful, kind of civilized debate. And in fairness, he did say in one of his early speeches that that's what he wanted to bring back to politics, rather than this kind of polarized, you know, back and forth in the Dáil and people shouting at each other. But I think he's trying to take the heat out of those Dáil exchanges, because Sinn Féin make hay, especially on social media, with those exchanges. But my worry is that, I don't know if it's a bit uninspiring, if he's not willing to kind of fight the corner twice as hard as the last guy, I think he risks losing a little bit of impact.
And you end up with a situation where Micheál Martin is the one who's pushing back against Sinn Féin.
I was actually going to say that. It is Micheál Martin, because I've watched him now for many years, but particularly the last 2 weeks since Simon Harris became Taoiseach. And I feel like he's redoubled even more. And actually, Micheál Martin looks like he enjoys that. I mean, sometimes when he's like giving it loads, you can see him actually smiling underneath it. I think that he is much more natural at getting into the fight, getting into the boxing ring. And I think Simon Harris is trying a different tack. He's trying the civilised debate. This is a new kind of politics, but I'm bringing an energy to it. I don't know how long it will last, because he's going to get tired and he's going to get tetchy. But we were talking about it in the office afterwards, Jack, and we were kind of saying, oh, not what we expected. Like,
yeah, so, icy civility is what Miriam Lord called it this week in her column. And I think she's right. And I think it is a conscious choice. I think Jen is correct in her assessment that he's trying to kind of take the higher ground in some ways. There was a lot of mentions of a presumption of good faith on behalf of Sinn Féin that he was making, particularly during his first leader's questions. And then almost this kind of disappointed moon tour kind of way of looking at them as they trotted out stats that he said were at variance with the reality of the situation on the ground when it came to healthcare. I can't remember whether it was Tuesday or Wednesday, but they proffered stats from the HSE showing year on year how many operations have been cancelled, and he said, but the HSE told you couldn't present them like this. So basically trying to suggest that Sinn Féin are operating in bad faith. And he was armed with a rake load of statistics that showed, you know, that the situation is in fact improving in many ways, etc., etc. I think that Jen is also right in saying that I wonder how long this is going
to
last.
Well, if you go from icy civility to disappointed moonshore in the space of a week, they'll be tearing each other's eyes out by the end of the month, won't they?
Very much so, yeah. I mean, I think what's interesting as well, I think perhaps even more so than how Simon Harris handled it and the sustainability of that strategy, is the angles of attack that not just Sinn Féin, but also the Social Democrats and Labour took, particularly on Tuesday. Both days, Sinn Féin went in on health stuff. And on Tuesday, the Social Democrats and Labour went in on abortion, and PPP as well went in on abortion. So they're kind of conjuring up, I think, this notion of Simon Harris as someone who promises new energy, but in fact is a kind of artifact of, you know, the kind of governing and governance that they charge Fine Gael with for many years, which is broken promises, over-promising, under-delivery. And they're doing that in an interesting way by trying to kind of hook their attack lines into his record as health minister. So things that he championed or things that he has said are going to form a central part of his kind of policy and government buildings, like disability, autism, you know, the disappointing way in which aspects of the abortion regime have worked out, and scoliosis as well. You know, scoliosis, which he made promises on when he was health minister, and clearly very significant issues remain there. So I think they're trying to kind of undermine some of the foundation myths
so
around Simon Harris
that he's
conducted for himself.
They have... they've gone through his CV with a red biro, and they've circled various things, and they've dragged them out. The scoliosis one, I think, is a particularly difficult one for him. But I suppose overall as well, Jen, that kind of pushes back against the narrative of here's the new guy. You know, he's going to be thinking new thoughts and for a new Ireland, and he's, you know, everything everywhere all at once, as you say, and he's like a Duracell bunny running around the place. And they're going, actually, no, he's an old guy. He's been knocking around for years, and he's just doing the same, I suppose, frankly, bullshit line that he did in his previous jobs. I noticed even this week it also even came up with something I wasn't even aware he'd been aware he was responsible for, which was apprenticeships, because there's problems in the apprenticeship scheme, and Sinn Féin were having a go at him over that too.
Yeah, the apprentice stuff, yeah, exactly. That was in his brief as well. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to present, they're basically trying to say, here's the new guy, but here's the things that he said he would deliver on and hasn't. And I think it was early in the week, RTÉ broadcast documentary on the kind of how the abortion services are operating now, and it was a difficult watch for anyone who watched it, you know, a lot of women who are still suffering. And one of the parts of it were women who are going to these rogue crisis pregnancy agencies and are being told things that are very dangerous and potentially very damaging. And they, all of a sudden, people remembered that when Simon Harris was the Minister for Health, he promised, I think he said he was like appalled and disgusted by the behaviour. And that was 8 years ago, to the best of my knowledge. The Times Ireland had that investigation 8 years ago. And he said he'd do something about it, and nothing was done. And we've talked a bit before about the way promises can be made by him, and does he deliver? So for him coming into this week, it was already a tough ask, I think. In his defence, I think, we talked about before about being the Minister for Health, how you're pulled in all kinds of different directions. And, you know, if you're not trying to put out the fires, you're dealing with 10,000 legacy issues or whatever it may be. And he, you know, you only have a certain amount of time there. And there's a lot of health ministers who made a lot of promises that weren't delivered on. But for him, I think it's trickier because it's open season now. We're months before the general election. And he will be held to account for things that he promised and didn't do. The other thing that I've noticed that he has done, which I think is really interesting, and you can look at this two ways. He is promising kind of various different things, which right now aren't ideas in the sky. You know, I'm hearing about this new childcare fund and a new model of childcare for people from disadvantaged backgrounds. So far, no solid detail on that. On the other hand, he's scrapping loads of different controversial things. So the Green Paper on Disability, there's a lot of opposition to that, gone. June's much anticipated referendum.
I'm so disappointed about this.
I know a few people who are disappointed about it, who did a lot of work on it in the lead up and then found out.
Who could they be?
People in the Electoral Commission, I think, probably have wasted a lot of time. So that's gone. That's not happening anymore. And then abortion itself, there was the paper in for the reforms and changes, and he was asked about it during the week, and he said one thing and another thing, but didn't actually give a definitive view. But reading between the lines, what he said was, we promised the people certain things when we had the referendum, and we have to be very cognizant of that. And then I did a piece in the back of it where I rang around government, and one minister said to me, there's no appetite for this, it's not going to happen. And a senior official said to me, not happening for the general election.
Political
it's just
trouble.
Too controversial.
In the famous words of Theresa Mannion, no unnecessary journeys before the election. Is that the kind of plan, Jack? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, we're going to see a bit of a kick for touch on the abortion stuff, as Jen reported this week. And that's a big thing, I think, you know, like that enacting the recommendations of the Marie O'Shea review would have been a big policy step. And they're clearly not, they don't have the appetite for it. So I think that instead what they're going to try to do is bring the focus to bear on little things or medium-sized things that buttress or support their core kind of reorientation around things like law and order. So this week there was a big hoo-ha about the knife crime stuff going to cabinet on Tuesday, and, like, you know, it's not nothing. And James Brown has been working away in his antisocial behaviour task force. I think it is a task force or a committee. I can't remember. But anyway, he's been beavering away for years on this, and has brought forward enhanced sentencing for certain knife related crimes. And it actually does, if you pardon the pun, cut through People, I think, do pick up on stuff like that. And here's a purely anecdotal way of illustrating that. But I was in a taxi on Wednesday morning, and the taxi man was like, delighted they're doing something on knife crime, you know. So it does get pick up. And, you know, this is someone who obviously works late at night and would have a kind of awareness of these things and probably a nervousness about these things as well. So it does cut through, I think. But like, is it a massive piece of legislative or substantial criminal justice reform? No. But what they're looking for are these little interventions that give the impression of a maelstrom of substantive activity. But as I think we've articulated on this podcast before, their latitude for doing big things is very restrained by time and by politics. I mean, they just don't have the political latitude to do something big around abortion now, because it would just divide the government internally too much.
You can box quite clever with small things, can't you?
And I think that's the whole strategy, they can cut through, to
use your phrase, if they're the right sorts of things. And there's, you know, small aids for businesses have been talked about a lot. They wouldn't be huge amounts of money, but you could certainly do them before the end of this year, couldn't you? You know, there are some bigger things. There's questions about, you know, VAT rates in relation to, you know, restaurants and things like that, aren't there?
Splitting the rate. Yeah, I mean, these are little mid-sized, like Jack says, interventions before the biggest intervention of them all, which would be the budget. And already we've seen in April budget kites flying. I mean, it's actually getting earlier and earlier every year. I want to bash my head off the wall when I see that.
I know, yeah.
Because it's just extra stress on us. But we're already seeing Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael fall over each other to say who's going to announce USC cuts, who's going to announce income tax package, or childcare, or whatever it might be. And it's really only April. And the VAT thing, Fine Gael is coming under massive pressure. It's to have the lower 9% rate for hospitality, for food businesses. But not for hotels.
That is
divisive. But I think there'll be resistance from Michael McGrath.
It's expensive, right?
Super.
So,
like,
I mean, the full
9%. Cut, millions.
Yeah. The full 9% cut is like 700 million or something like that.
Yeah,
now, Neil Richmond, I think, was on the radio as recently as this morning saying you can kind of slice and dice in a certain way so it'll come in cheaper. But like, I think that will be something for the budget. And actually, I'd be surprised if they don't get some version of it over the line for the budget.
Just the
political exigencies of the situation dictate that they have to.
And they'll do
something on PRSI between now and the budget.
They'll do that next month, I think. It'll be a business package, and they'll package it. They'll make it seem really, you know, massive and a huge deal and be very glossy, I'm sure. But it's very easily done. It's basically changing the PRSI rates for businesses.
I suspect there'll be something on migration as well. And I know we're going to get on to the migration pact, but you know, they are facing a situation where they have a huge, well, the Ukrainian side of the ledger has run all the way down. Things are going quite well. There's fewer Ukrainians seeking accommodation and more leaving accommodation. But when it comes to international protection, they have a massive problem. But the levers they can pull to kind of influence that are much fewer, you know. So they've been effective in suppressing the number of Ukrainians coming by limiting the offering. I don't think you can do that for international protection. So I think they're going to try and contrive some way, perhaps more countries on the safe countries list, which would
definitely
lower the numbers coming from there.
Stricter rules of doors of airplanes.
They'll try and figure. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And fines, as you reported during the week, Jen, more fines for airlines.
Yeah.
They'll try and configure some package, which I'd be dubious about how much of an impact it would have, but again, it gives the impression of action, and I think that's kind of the roll of the dice, that they'll do as much as they can to give an impression and hope that, you know, of those policy actions, things drop through to the bottom line and make a difference. But the gamble is on, you know, the impression of action.
What about RTE? That's a fairly big decision. He
yeah.
said he's going to make it before the summer, which I take it to mean before the dole rises, so July, that we'll get a call. And it still seems highly unlikely to me that they would go for the model of a universal charge at this point. Probably that would be the most unpopular option just before an election, wouldn't it?
They're not going to do that just before an election. I mean, I think it will be... It might make sense in some ways, but if they're thinking highly politically now, just before an election, like you said, no. Yeah, I was told that he is 100% going to make a decision by the summer recess, but I've been told many things down through the years that turned out not to be true. But, you know, as of last night, the reports haven't landed. So these are the reports that Catherine Martin's waiting on corporate governance, the barter account.
They've been due for quite a while now, haven't they?
They've been due for a while.
They kind of have half landed in some ways.
Like
they're
yeah,
going through like a fact checking process,
in the
and it's just kind of like, yeah, but
yeah.
I bet you could have a peek at the draft.
So she's about to, Catherine Martin's about to come back into the news cycle in a way that I'm sure she wishes was not happening. But yeah, so that he'll have a big decision to make there. I think realistically, what they'll do is they'll go with a revenue collection model of a of the TV license. I don't think they'll go direct Exchequer funding, and I don't think they'll go broadcasting charge.
What's interesting as well, though, is that there is a fault line in the coalition over this.
Yeah.
And I interviewed Eamon Ryan yesterday for a piece for tomorrow for Saturday's paper, because the Greens are having their, what are they calling it? It's an annual convention, I think. So there you go. But he was basically saying, look, whatever model she comes with, I'm going to back her. And he believes that the other coalition leaders will agree on it as well. So, I mean,
and she favors
she's sent to favor direct Exchequer funding.
Mm.
So, I mean,
if she comes and says,
look, it's Exchequer funding, and if Eamon Ryan goes, grand, I'll back you.
Yeah, so then it's Eamon Ryan versus Michael McGrath versus Simon Harris.
Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath, neither of them would be very keen on.
Yeah, so
I think it's a big task
for Harris then to kind of forge a consensus around that. And it's something that I think Micheál Martin was quite good when he was Taoiseach at.
What is his view? I actually don't know what his view is.
He did an interview on this week, like in December on it. And I think that he basically expressed deep scepticism as well on the Exchequer funding model. I'd have to check that.
That's interesting.
But it's subject to revision, of course. But just to return to, like, when Micheál Martin was Taoiseach, I thought he was quite good at kind of finding the landing zone and the consensus forming kind of element of government. Leo Varadkar maybe not quite so good at that. So this is the test for how good Harris is.
I mean, I can see a situation in which, you know, they say we are going to transition from a license fee to a broadcast charge, but it will take place over a 5-year period.
And we'll have a subvention
to public service broadcasting to make up the shortfall in the license fee process. And then they've laid the ground
for that already by saying things like, you know, the license fee is going to be around for a while yet, you know, certainly for all of 2024, maybe a bit of 2025, and maybe until after the election.
Actually, dead serious, you've just displayed some Taoiseach-like qualities.
He's going to be working government buildings.
I actually have a question for you.
I'm going to turn the tables on you.
Go on.
Just, you've interviewed loads of interesting people on the podcast about kind of populism and... If you're looking at Harris and the choices to make, on one hand, he's scrapping loads of things, you know, disability paper, the green paper or whatever, and the other hand, he's promising these kind of things. Do you think it's populism to
scrap things
that are difficult?
Well, you could ask 10 different people what the definition of populism is, and I think you'd get 10 different answers. So it's, I mean, I think the most simplistic version of it is, you know, just giving the stupid people the stupid things they stupidly want in order to get stupidly reelected. I think it's actually a bit more complicated than that. It does feed into certain kinds of strands, as we know, you know, as we've seen across the world, both left populism and right populism. I think it's a little bit more of just, you know, trying to bribe the people. You know, in that sense, if that's what it was, well, then it's just something that's always been part of politics, isn't it? Whereas I think the way we talk about it now, I don't know what you think, Jack, it's something new. It's something that's been around, but it's got a resurgence at the moment.
Yeah.
I think one of the main things is it tends to hold up an idea of who the real people are, you know? And I don't think Fine Gael giving a couple of tax breaks to people kind of feeds into that.
No, and actually that's one of the things Simon Harris said when he first was elected, that he came into the Dáil. One of the things he didn't like was that people were standing up saying, I represent the real people of Ireland, mm-hmm. the real working people
of
Ireland.
Well, we hear more of that.
And he said, well, who do I, you know, they said, I represent the ordinary people. He said, do I represent the extraordinary people?
People of Greystones.
Well, they are quite extraordinary there, but it's a lovely place. But yeah, I just thought that was interesting. Just in terms of his style of leadership, is it clever? Is it smart
I mean, I don't think he could be understood as a populist in the modern incarnation, you know, the kind of people
Indeed.
That we...
Oh, I definitely wouldn't call him a populist.
Yeah.
Is it a populist thing to do, to scrap things that are not popular? Anyway.
Well, one of the interesting people I was talking to was a few weeks back, some listeners will have heard, it was David Reif, and I was talking to him actually outside the podcast. He knows an awful lot about Argentina, and Argentina knows a lot about different kinds of populism, because Peronism, which was a very successful political movement, has kind of shaped Argentina over the last half century. And one of the interesting things that happened there was that it was like Fianna Fáil on steroids, you know, and they basically just, you know, it was a patronage-run political system where you got jobs in the civil service if you came from the right family and all that kind of stuff. And it's been incredibly divisive. And actually, it's turned the whole idea of left and right upside down, because the people who are opposed to the government are the poorest people, and they're actually voting right because it's the people who have a vested interest in the continuation of the civil service and public service, you know, who are voting left. So the world gets turned upside down in that kind of a way. But I don't think there's any sign of anything like that. happening here right now, is there?
Famous last words.
Well, the other thing that feeds into populism, of course, is if your economy is going down the toilet, which is what's happening in Argentina.
You've stolen one of my favourite potted things to say to make me sound kind of vaguely clever. Peronism is Fianna Fáil on steroids. Can't believe that. People are going to think I'm ripping you off now.
Did you say that?
Possibly not on the podcast, but I've been saying it for years.
Oh my goodness.
You said it to you in the pub,
I must have somehow taken it by osmosis. I apologise for plagiarising you without even realising it. We are going to move on to another subject, which populism does feed into a little bit. And this is the whole question of the EU Migration Pact, which was agreed a couple of weeks ago. It was passed by the European Parliament. Simon Harris is in favour of it, but there may be rows brewing, Jen.
Yeah, I think it's going to dominate a lot of proceedings next week in the Dáil. It's also going to go to the Justice Committee. It was a big talking point in at least the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party meeting this week. And this is, like you said, the EU Migration Pact. And I spent some time yesterday evening because I knew kind of the outline, but I didn't know kind of the detail of it. And I think that's the problem with something like this, really, is people hear certain snippets, understandably, like I've said before, people are very busy and they hear it and they think, I don't agree with that. Mm. And this is a really big reform. It's probably the biggest reform to our international protection laws in the last number of decades. So I'll just take you through exactly what it is. So it will give every member state three options to manage migration. So the first one would be, and this is a controversial one, to relocate a certain number of asylum seekers or pay €20,000 for each claimant that the country refuses to relocate, or finance operational support. So that could be like sending staff or equipment. And the overall aim across the entirety of the EU is for 30,000. Well, it's not an aim, but that's the pool basically for relocation. So people on the far right have said it doesn't go far enough. People on the left have said it goes too far, and they're raising concerns around the welfare of refugees, about human dignity, because one of the things that it would propose would be that when people arrive, they'd be put, now we're phrasing it as accommodation centres. Other European countries have almost portrayed this view of, you know, like
detention
centres with a, yeah, you know, fence with the high barbed wire on top. And it's finding out exactly what the reality is. I mean, one of the aims of it is to process people who arrive much, much faster. And that sounds great to many people, but look at the reality of how long we take to process applications. Last year, the median time, I think, for international protection applicants was 13 months. And that's after they put loads of resources into speeding it up. So,
and one of the criticisms, I think, from sort of human rights organisations is that if you speed up this process too much, you're going to get a lot more miscarriages of justice and you're going to get, you know, wrongful decisions of one sort or another.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there's that. And then the other controversial part, which I think is the one that will become the talking point, is the fact that it relocates decision making to Brussels effectively. So the decisions about how this system will change in the future or how it will operate in the present day are made kind of at that EU level. And the argument the government has made is, we can't go with this on our own. We can't just make our own rules. If we decide to just be an outlier, we're actually going to suffer more. Like, we need to actually all work together as a European Union. So there's that argument. But then there's the argument about sovereignty, because this would repeal the entirety of the International Protection 2015 Act. And that's a big job. And like, to go through that process will take us all the way to 2026. And even people like Donald Tusk, I think he's in a centre-right party, he has you know, raised opposition about it, surprisingly, talking about sovereignty. And I think there's also been, not veiled threats, but kind of comments made in the last week that countries who don't opt in, they could suffer. I mean, are they alluding to financial fines? I don't know. But I do think it's going to become one of those things where the government have a job to communicate to people not only exactly what the proposal is, but the parts where people are anxious about, to address it honestly and say, okay,
and
yeah, this is what would happen.
Of people who are anxious, isn't it? I mean, Sinn Féin are not opposed to it in its entirety, as far as I understand, but they're opposed to signing up for most of it. They're in favour of, there's some elements about, you know, cooperation between, you know, police forces and things like that, you know, passport checks and that kind of thing. So, and then we have, I'd say, from the point of view of the government, Jack, the grim spectre, the shadow of Michael McDougall rising up again and saying, this shall not pass. And then they have recent memories and scars to bear.
Or at least an early Doors version of this shall not pass, which is this is subject to insufficient parliamentary scrutiny.
It doesn't quite work quite as well at the barricades,
no,
does it?
No, not quite. He's not quite to the barricades yet, but I think he's going to end up there. And I think that, you know, for figures within and without the Oireachtas, MacDuill is becoming something of a kind of rallying point figure to pick these kind of flashpoint issues. And I think that people like Fiona Murphy and others on the independent benches will kind of follow where he leads on things like this. And I think that this is something that I agree entirely with Jen on. I think that the government thought this was going to be an easy win, to be frank. Like we were saying earlier on, that they're looking for low-hanging fruit that they can kind of do quickly and give the appearance of kind of quite dramatic reform. And I think that they saw this and they said, right, we have a vulnerability on immigration. This looks like us being tough on immigration because it's a lot faster processing, you know, it's a lot firmer, and that's the lines they've offered on defence in this. But I think that's a miscalculation because in line with things that have blown back in their faces recently, like hate speech and the referendums, this unites opposition from both left and right polls. And to be frank, it does look like a fairly minimalistic engagement with the Oireachtas. Like it's going through
That's MacDuill's objection, which is that this is a huge change for Ireland, and it just basically gets waved through the process.
And Patrick Tobin was talking about this during the week, you know, and there's that kind of soft Euroscepticism, you know. I wouldn't compare Paddy to Nigel Farage, heaven forbid it, but like, you know, that kind of political recipe, you know, interference from Brussels on a migration thing, like people. There's a track record there, at least in the neighbouring jurisdiction, of people reacting to that. So it's interesting to see whether people will react to that here. And 3 hours in the Justice Committee next week is not an awfully long amount of time to be looking at that. And I understand there's some back and forth within that committee about the extent to which they're going to look at it. So I think it's going to be a flashpoint next week. And I think it's one of those things that it's a wicked problem for the government, because their opponents, no matter where they come from the political spectrum, will look into this issue and this particular pact and see something they don't like.
So could that blow up perhaps for the European elections, given that it is a European issue? And in fact, really, I think the backdrop to this is that this is an attempt by the current powers that be in the EU and the European Parliament to make some changes in this issue before the elections, in which immigration is quite possibly going to be the single biggest issue in quite a lot of countries, and you might see a rather differently shaped European Parliament after that.
Yeah, there have been loads of surveys that show that immigration in terms of the European elections is the number one issue. And I think that for years and years, the European Union has been promising to reform the legislation, because it's very piecemeal according to the different country that you're in. And there have been attempts to do it and they haven't been successful. But I think, you know, as we move closer to the European elections, I think European leaders have seen kind of the rise in their own countries of more right-wing parties through polling and whatever. And I think they've started to lean a little bit more right themselves.
That would be the EPP in particular, Fine Gael's party.
Absolutely. Mm. And then I think this was supposed to be the thing that they waved up before the European elections and say, look, we did do something. Here it is. And there's also an urgency, I think, from what I've read, that they want to have this passed before Hungary takes over the presidency. And they want to get this over the line before those elections, because there's a feeling that after the elections that such a reform would be impossible. So there's kind of a time pressure there as well. And I think that kind of feeds into some of the pressure that's on the government to get a pass. But when I talked to the Fianna Fáil TDs who brought it up at the parliamentary party the other night, you know, they weren't kind of just saying like, scrap it or anything mad at it, but they were saying there's a lot of detail in this and it hasn't really been teased out. And it is the kind of thing that would be ripe for misinformation as well.
It's a legitimate point, though, isn't it? It's a real shortfall in a legislative process that something like that gets.
Yeah, I believe that the Dáil Business Committee met this week, and whatever was said behind closed doors, the Ceann Comhairle agreed that whatever time is needed in the Dáil for it will be given, whatever that may be. I think that shows the pressure.
The intention is just to do the Justice Committee on it, isn't it?
I think they're going to make time for a Dáil debate as well.
I think it does need a Dáil and Shannon vote anyway.
It does need a vote. It doesn't need a referendum, but it does need a vote under the existing existing legislation. But then, like I said, it's 2 years to kind of transpose it. But by that stage, you know, if it's voted through by the Dáil, it's voted through by the Dáil. So there's a whole thing that needs to happen before.
It's one of these really complex things as well. Yeah. So people can kind of project on what they want and take and cherry pick from it what they want when they're making arguments against it. So again, it's just another example.
That's why you can see on both sides, on the left and right, some say it goes too far, some say it doesn't go far enough. Mm. And does it fall in the middle? I actually don't know. It's really complicated. And even the idea of how, two questions, how many people will Ireland have to relocate? No answer. There is, and I don't mean to be super boring, but it is basically the solidarity pool and the proportion is the fair share principle. So it's based on 50% population and 50% GDP. We have one of the highest GDPs in Europe, but I think one of the lowest populations.
Yeah, that GDP is a terrible pain in the neck.
So, I know.
It just keeps getting in the way.
They keep slapping us across the head with it. Yeah. But there's that. And then the other thing is the cost. And Taoiseach Simon Harris was asked about this during the week. And he said it's actually impossible to put a cost on it. But then he said, actually, if we don't sign up to it, we'll have a higher cost because it addresses secondary movements. And half of the people, I think he said half of the asylum seekers who arrived to Ireland last year were through secondary movements. So,
as in from another EU country.
Exactly, they've gone through another EU country before.
Which kind of makes sense because, you know, most people have to come through an EU country to get here.
100%. Yeah, so it's an interesting one. I think we'll be talking about it again.
We will definitely be talking about it again. We are going to take a quick break. We'll be back after this.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office. Made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
And you're very welcome back. Jen and Jack are here. Jack, the Green Party has its, you mentioned earlier, its convention this
National
weekend.
National convention.
Get it
right.
Will that be the last one before the election?
Yes. Yeah. Well, we're less than a year from the election, so unless they do one,
so as it,
first half of next year, or the first
have
little
in
part
September,
of next year,
maybe, I don't know.
They could do, yeah.
So as it sits down and examines its navel and considers its existential position,
yeah, pretty pleased with itself, to be frank. But that only gets you so far down the road. Like the Greens are really. I mean the Greens of the parliamentary party because it does have that kind of cranky rump to it. But the majority of the Greens in the parliamentary party certainly, and its leadership in HQ and ministers, like they are fiercely proud of what they've done in government. They see themselves as having instituted long-lasting, far-reaching legislative reforms, and there is that kind of possibly apocryphal story of the civil servant offering the observation that, you know, Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar will come and go, but you'll be dealing with Eamon Ryan's legacy for the next 30 years.
Do you think that's true?
I don't know, to be frank. It strikes me as credible anyway, like because of the Climate Act and the emission ceilings and the degree to which we are now kind of bound into climate action by legislation as opposed to by just policy or politics or, you know, programs for government or anything like that. So it does strike me as credible. And they also believe that they've done a lot for people on the ground. They talk about things like public transport fares. They talk a lot about childcare, even though, you know, that is everyone in government wants to own that one. And they talk a lot about like things like the energy credits, which again they want to claim credit for. So they're pretty pleased with themselves, their time in government. And I think that, you know, the way they've approached being a junior partner in a coalition is an interesting one. I think early and often it was quite clear they weren't going to be the watchdog for the other parties. They weren't. And I remember the Seamus Wolf controversy over his appointment to the Supreme Court. And I think that we all thought this was going to follow the traditional pattern of the smaller party calling out the bigger parties. And there was just not a peep from them. And they've shown a disinterest in sweating the small stuff that may seem big at the time.
So long as
they're getting the green stuff through.
So that's
an interesting kind of blueprint for being in government. The problem is that like their polling is only okay. They hit a big slide in 2021. They actually held up okay. This is in the Irish Times poll. They held up okay after they went into government. They actually went up to 12% in one poll, but I think that might have been a bit of a rogue. And then they had a slide in 2021. They've recovered a little bit to 5%, but and 10% in Dublin, which is really important for them because they've 8 of their 12 TDs there. But even on those numbers, which have improved, they'll lose seats. So, you know, the possibility for an entirely climate-focused or mostly climate-focused party being as prominent in the next Dáil is reduced. And it strikes me that they should be a little more worried about that, to be honest.
I suppose the thing is, Jen, that they were always going to lose seats, weren't they? After 5 years in government, a small party, Irish political history tells us that's almost universally the case. And they set out, they had very clear objectives, probably a lot clearer than most political parties have, you know, in terms of what their priorities are. So is there not an element here of damage reduction? If, as Jack is saying, you know, their numbers aren't great, but they're not too bad in Dublin, it's about holding on to, you know, 7, 8 of the 12 seats that you have, and therefore possibly still having a role to play in the government after the election.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting because the Green Party they've been eviscerated before. They've been completely kind of wiped out in terms of parliamentary representation. And for them, I feel like it is often this case of kind of an ebb and flow for them, where they kind of come back and then they're kind of wiped out again. And they always kind of just consistently remain. Like the Labour Party are always facing this sort of challenge of people talking about extinction. It never seems to quite be those for the Green Party. And I think a lot of that is because of, they have, like you said, this raison d'etre, and that is climate change. And for them, they have totally focused on policy. I personally think that's a good thing. Like, I think they can point to 4 really good things that they have achieved. The Climate Act, to put into law our emissions targets for 2030, childcare, like Jack says, everybody's trying to steal that. Mm. But the Minister for Children is Roger O'Gorman, to be fair. And then I think the pilot scheme for artists as well, I think that's one thing that they'll be able to hold up and say, you know, we brought that in, and I don't know how successful it's been.
There's research, ongoing research on it. I don't think we've seen kind of numbers on that. Also, it's very difficult to actually, you know, it's not necessarily easy to measure. You know, has the quality of art gone up in Ireland since the scheme was, you know?
Well, if you look at Oscars, you know, and whatnot, but
the critics on the case. Yeah. You know, yeah.
But look,
count up the number of stars.
It's impossible to assess the effectiveness of that scheme, really. Like, I mean,
oh yeah, and so, sorry, I was going to say the 4th thing was public transport. Yeah.
Our artists are going to say we like free money, and I think that the Greens are going to try and continue or expand that or put that on a permanent footing.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that Catherine Martin has delivered, you know, more than any other arts minister, with the arguable exception of Michael D. Higgins in the 90s, to the kind of the various communities that make films and do theatre.
And these things can have a kind of outsized impact, even though the vast majority of people strolling up and down Tara Street now wouldn't care, to be frank, about that. Like, as a legacy piece, like, you know, the tax-free income for artists that was brought in the 1990s, I think.
People might care about public transport fares. I know that's important to my family, people's fares have gone down, you know, substantially.
Well, I was saying to Jack yesterday that I use public transport pretty much at least twice a day, and I use a Leap card, and that 30 euro, my Leap card tops up by 30 euro automatically, that goes way further. And I've noticed it, like, it would last me 2 weeks now or whatever. And that's a tangible thing that I think people will and have noticed. And whether that becomes an issue in the budget to continue those cuts is another question, really. And that's,
I suspect those cuts will continue through to the election. In fact, Eamon Ryan's kind of indicating as much in the piece tomorrow.
I think they can't stand over those things. As for the next election, they need at least 6 seats to be considered.
I mean, the other thing, isn't
candidate.
It, about the Greens that has happened over the years is that they have become this kind of hate figure for certain other parts of the Irish political spectrum, whether it be farmers or people on the hard right or a number of people, but particularly those two. And I don't know how that feeds into the general narrative. I mean, should that cause them to be concerned?
Well, like, I mean, it's probably an effective rallying point for a bunch of people who weren't going to vote for them anyway. Yeah. So I think that they are useful as a political tool for politicians on the right or on the kind of reactionary side of things to personify what it is that they're campaigning against and what it is they're not. Do you know what I mean? Like Eamon Ryan, this kind of slightly sleepy, well-intentioned guy who annoys you by saying things that you don't agree with. And Roderick O'Gorman, this progressive minister for integration who has presided over a huge influx in refugees and asylum seekers. And, you know, these are convenient rallying points. I think that the Greens kind of, it annoys them. to some extent. But I think the underlying political reality is that, like, they're vastly different pools of voters. So I don't think there's anyone who might have voted for the Greens, you know, and isn't voting for the Greens next time out because they've done stuff in transport, energy, agriculture, and in immigration.
So if we were to accept that point, Jen, is it not the case that the real electoral contest, first of all in June, and then at the general election, is three parties who are fighting in the same pool of voters, really, which is the Soc Dems, who are a nose ahead, according to most polls at the moment, the Greens and the Labour Party. And that's a kind of a, I don't want to stereotype it too much, but it's a kind of third level educated, middle class, progressive, largely urban vote.
I definitely think that's true. They are fighting in the same pool for the same voters. There's no doubt about it. And the conventional wisdom for the last number of years has been, especially after 2020 general election, when we saw how well Sinn Féin did, was that these parties would be in the locals and the next general very vulnerable to Sinn Féin. We don't know if that's true until we actually, you know, are in the polling centre or the count centre on election day. But I do believe they will be vulnerable to Sinn Féin. I think even parties like PPP be vulnerable to them. Some of the candidates came in the last time kind of on the back of Sinn Féin not running enough candidates in that kind of wave. But they are fishing around for a lot of the same votes. And I think it is interesting sometimes to look at the policies that the opposition kind of put forward. A lot of them are the same in terms of housing or otherwise, or either the same or quite similar. So they've got a battle there.
So, I mean, the Greens, I mean, obviously, for, you know, the climate is more important to them than it is to the other parties. But, the Social Democrats would claim that it's very important to them, and Labour would as well, wouldn't they?
They would, but it's nowhere more evident than the Green Party.
Yeah, I know. Agree. Yeah, no, it's why they exist. And actually, it's the one thing that I think unites the Greens. Like, I think when you delve into political opinions on other things within the Greens, you find a much greater scope. You know, like, there's people who are very left and very progressive on things like, you know, and they coalesce around that just transition side. And then there's people who are kind of, and Eamon Ryan has been described to me by other people in government as basically a libertarian on other things, you know. So the thing that binds them together is ecological politics and climate change. And, you know, that's what they put into programs for government. And the fact of the matter is that even though other parties on the centre left or the left have policies in this area, you know, when they're going into the program for government negotiations, if they do end up in there and if they have enough seats to be relevant, it's one of several issues as opposed to the issue.
And they could also argue in the election, like, I think one of the things they could, if I'm imagining what kind of pitch they'll make to the electorate, they could say, you know, that progress that they have made, although their own supporters always feel that it's not enough, or maybe they've compromised on certain things, they could say that, like, take for example the $3 billion climate fund, which they secured, that should they not be in, that will be, you know, pilfered, squandered, whatever, it'll be raided and it won't be used for the same purpose. Will that be enough to convince people to vote Green? I just don't know. I don't know. Is climate the number one issue on people's minds?
Well, the polls say no, but it is important to a subset of voters.
Yes.
Isn't that true?
And I think, was it during the general election? Was it the exit poll showed that it was down the list of priorities, and yet the Green Party did quite well? So,
Anyway, every week at this time we choose articles which have caught our attention across IrishTimes.com and in the print newspaper. Jen, your one is very timely. A certain pop star.
Taylor Swift, yep, she has her new album. Well, let me just say, it was supposed to be one album and I woke up this morning early to listen to it. It was two albums, so I didn't schedule nearly enough time to listen to the album. So I've been trying to, like, squeeze it in between running around. But
this is a very old man's question here. Is that what a double album is called now, two albums?
Haven't a clue. Did I say that? I'm a bit tired. I've had a lot of coffee and I've had no wine yet.
And also, how does that work, you know, so given that there is no actual physical album?
Oh, yeah, well, there's lots of vinyl, but there's lots of very expensive and I have issues with that. But anyway, so she was supposed to release her album. There's basically 15 extra songs. It's Tortured Poets Department. And Derek Scally was writing a piece on Wednesday about the city of, I hope I pronounced this right, Heidelberg. Heidelberg. And basically, it's church, two booked out church services that are playing the music of Taylor Swift rather than other more churchly music, and to try and get more people to come. And as someone who is going to an exercise themed Taylor Swift class on Sunday, I can understand, because it's making me want to go and exercise where I
an
normally.
Exercise themed Taylor Swift
it's a
class,
spin
or
class,
or is it a Taylor Swift themed exercise
it's
class?
It's a tortured poet department's spin class.
Okay.
Yeah. So you don't notice that you're nearly dead because you're listening to your favourite song.
So it must be a fairly boppy album if you can do a spin class.
It's actually not really. I was actually thinking this morning.
Quite a slow moving.
I was like, we're all going to be crying.
Okay, yeah, sounds easy.
Well, I thought we're all going to be crying on that bike. Like, it's going to be a bit depressing. Thank God there's booze afterwards. But
is the album good?
I really like it. I do. I think some of the lyrics are hilarious. I think she's. It's the first time I think that she's actually attacking some of her listeners. She hasn't really done that before. This time she's kind of, and it's more of a reflection on Fame than her ex-boyfriends, which I'm relieved to see. But I'm a fan of hers. Not like a.
I gather her
obsession.
Her
Swiftie.
Former boyfriend, Matty Healy, comes badly out of it.
Matty
Healy. Comes out terrible. I actually read one of. The, I actually
sounds
can't.
Like an inter-county player.
Matty Healy. I actually can't even repeat to you what I sent you for the description of one of the songs about him. I would hate to be him right now. But that was my pick, and that will be my plans for the weekend. I will be drinking wine, listening to Taylor Swift, and then I will be exercising.
You're not a cliche at all, Jen.
I'm a complete cliche, and I'm not afraid to admit it.
I have a much more serious story. It is in its own way, which is Conor Pope had a story this week, and I think he'll be writing about it again over the weekend. Absolutely outrageous story, really. The Air, the very large Irish telecoms operator, used to be owned by the state and it isn't anymore. It was cut out, really, and it was described as, its behaviour was described as disgraceful. Court heard about the way it treats its customers. It had rules which were essentially telling its staff that they would be disciplined if they told the customers what their rights were, or indeed how to make a complaint at all, which is just kind of extraordinary. And I think one of the things about this story, and it's one of the reasons it hits, is that it tells you something that you always felt you knew,
yeah,
and you never got the evidence of it, and here's the evidence, and everybody goes, I knew this is what these
in a handbook, yeah. Now they yeah. came out after and said, oh, it's been misinterpreted.
I saw it. How do you misinterpret?
You don't. And I was with Air for many, many years, and I just can't. I actually get PTSD when I think about times I tried to like make complaints, like pull my hair out territory.
Yeah.
So I believe every word.
And it wasn't just incompetence. It was all deliberate.
No.
You've got an interesting article. Our friend Patrick Frayne was writing this week about a new Irish television show, Jack.
Yeah. The name of the show I've forgotten already. Hang on, let me just check. The Full Irish. The Full Irish Hidden Camera Show understands the crack must be baited, captured and solemnly clubbed to death.
That's Patrick's
words. Patrick Frayne.
Rather than the RTE blurb.
Yeah, not the RTE guide. on Thursday, and I enjoyed this piece a lot more than I enjoyed the...
So you actually saw... Did you sit down to watch this?
No. I can't remember what day it went out. It was Monday or Tuesday, but I sat down and had a crap day. I was on earlies this week and I was writing the digest for the following morning and I knew I had to get up at 6 to finish it. And there'd been a nightmare bedtime with the kids and I was just in a foul humour.
And look at
this
me.
Came
you said,
on.
Our public service broadcast, this is what I pay my licence fee for, to be entertained.
I was one of those guys, emphatically so. And I couldn't find the remote, so like I couldn't turn it off. And then my wife came in and we were just watching it and like it just ruined my mood even more. And I feel bad almost
what
in some
it?
Ways. It's a hidden camera show peopled by Donal O'Callaghan, the former Irish rugby player and now 2FM host, and I think his co-host on 2FM as well, Darren Gary and Carl Mullen.
Yeah.
And like, it's just such a bad version of what it could be. And it also hinges on the idea that, you know, people don't know who these three
it's
guys
a hidden
are.
Camera show. Yeah.
It's a hidden camera show with three high profile people hosting it who are entirely recognizable at nearly all times. So I don't know how gullible people are or they presume people to be.
Is it just an Irish thing? They're just being polite and pretending they don't recognize Donal
O'Callaghan. I genuinely think that might be it. Like they're just, they don't want to
good
make
God.
Donal O'Callaghan feel bad. So they kind of go along and they go, oh, that's gas anyway. Sign the release and just hope that it gets canned before it goes out. But it didn't. It did go out. And
but this is surely a new level of Irish masochism that they're being polite even though they recognize Donal O'Callaghan, and then the whole purpose of the show is to humiliate them and make them look like idiots.
Exactly, yeah. And he's so recognisable because he's massive. like, you know, it's just like he's so instantly recognizable as Donal Cogallan, no matter what kind of comedy mustache they put on him. Anyway, I'm just going to stop because
before we started recording, we had a long discussion about why is it that RTE has always been the place where comedy goes to die. That's a discussion we might explore.
You have great opinions. I think you should share them.
They've done some great stuff. I was perusing. This is a damning indictment of what I do in my free time. But the Reddit thread on Reddit Ireland for the Hardy Books is like. Do you remember the Hardy Books?
I do remember the Hardy Books. Are you going to say the Hardy Books was good?
It was brilliant. I loved the Hardy Books. Oh, we're gonna fall out over this. Okay.
I think this is going to get nasty. I think we should leave it there and switch off the recording. If it was, thanks very much to Jen, and thanks very much up until that last contribution to Jack.
We'll who is no longer invited on the podcast.
Well, we might see you at some point in the future if you make a full apology. Thanks also to our producer Declan Conlon. We'll be back after the weekend. Until then, thanks very much for listening.